Coming back to the more serious business of crime, living between the Costa del Sol and a family home somewhere in Dublin, the crime bosses who currently control the drug supply and serious criminal activity in this country are millionaires and a mystery to most of us. To shed some light on who these crime bosses are, the money they have and how they are different to the criminals that went before them, I'm joined in studio now by the investigations editor of the Sunday World, Nicola Tallant, and retired Detective Inspector Brian Cherry. And in our Cork studio, we'll be joined shortly as well by Dr. Niamh Harrigan, a senior lecturer in sociology at UCC, who has been looking at the criminal environment in Limerick primarily. Now, good morning to you all, and thank you for coming in. Nicola, I suppose a broad question to you, first of all, who are these guys?
Well, they're guys that have grown up, I suppose, in largely criminal areas of Dublin. They come from Crumlin, they come from the Talla regions, they come from the north side, and they have seen generations before them succeed in criminality, and they're a new breed as such, but they've become more and more successful. A lot of them have been run out of Ireland by new legislation that's been brought in here over the past two decades, and they've set up in Spain. They travel between Spain and their homesteads here.
Who are the main players?
Well, the main player is Christy Kinahan. He is originally from Cabra, middle-class family in Cabra in County Dublin, and he has made his way up a chain of command that has seen him now. He's presiding over a mob, an Irish mob, who have reached proportions we've never seen before. He would be equal to the Russian and the Colombian mobs in size and scale out in the Costa, and he controls most of what happens here.
Most of the drugs coming into this country, he's organised them,
well,
or his people.
A figure which is quite astounding, but is what the guards here suspect, is that he traffics 90% of the drugs into the country. 90% of all the drugs in Ireland is sourced through him.
Is he wanted in this country, or does he just come and go as it suits him?
Well, he's been out of this country for a long time. So, I mean, obviously, the guards here can't police him because he's based out in Spain. But his, I suppose, what comes down from him, the tentacles of his business, is what's policed here. He's out in Spain at the moment. He's before the courts there since 2010 after Operation Shovel saw 22 of his gang members arrested in, it was a mainly money laundering investigation, and €500 million worth of assets, including a portion of Brazil that he had bought up, was frozen. So the Spanish system works slightly different to ours in that the magistrates investigate what the police have investigated. So it's a very, very slow process.
And what kind of organisation would he have? In other words, how many people, how many henchmen does he have? How many people does he have working for him?
Well, just to give you a little example of it, there's an area of Dublin 8, which we would call Fortress Gangland. And it's an area where very large criminal families have sort of intermarried and all the rest of it. And it would be his base here in Dublin. But it would take in, say, Oliver Bond House up to Maryland and around Mead Street, Francis Street, Thomas Street, that area. And in just that few square miles, there's about 250 criminals operating in six gangs. And they're absolutely, it's just enormous. And they pretty much, in a way, police it themselves, in that they have spotters out constantly. They use mafia techniques of counter-surveillance constantly to keep an eye that nobody's coming into their territory or they're not being put under surveillance.
You say six gangs, do they cooperate with each other or are they rivals?
No, they're largely under the umbrella of the Kinahan gang. The main sort of player there would be a guy called Greg Lynch. Brian may remember him, I don't know. He was 19 when he got his first conviction he was caught with 400 grand's worth of heroin. But Greg Lynch is only 29, maybe 30 now. He basically survived an assassination attempt last year. He had half his face shot off. But he is so paranoid. And I mean, this is an example of how the police are dealing.
He's a guy with convictions.
He has, yes. This is an example, I suppose, of how the guards have to try and sort of break into this world. He won't speak indoors in a house for fear of it being bugged. He won't carry a mobile phone. He won't carry ID. He'll only meet with contacts outside, and he'll only use burner phones, which are dumped within 2 days so as the guards can't get up on them. you know, on the phones. They don't have long enough. They're just used and dumped. And extremely paranoid. But a system like nearly you might have seen on the series The Wire, with the phones and how he makes his contacts. But he would be the kind of the most feared of them in the area.
Brian Sherry, you are retired, I think, about 6 or 7 years now from Garda Síochána. You had a long career as a detective and a detective inspector. Now, previously, we would have had names like Martin Cahill, who was murdered, I think, just over 20 years ago. John Gilligan, notoriously. Is there much of a difference in your view between people like those, that pair, and the more modern ones?
Oh, there is, Sean. There's a huge difference altogether now. Compared to years ago, I had the benefit of seeing most of these young people grow, as they say, into a new sort of criminality. They've absolutely no respect for life as we know it. And they themselves don't expect to live very long either, you know, because of the type of business that they're involved in. So, in their business, it's get in, get as much enjoyment as out of life as you possibly can, make as much money as you can, as quick as you can, and spend it as well.
Do any of them have, if I can use this phrase in inverted commas, the good sense to make the money and get out?
Very, very few. And unfortunately, from what I have seen, the vast majority of them don't get out. The bottom line is usually that they rise to a certain level within the ranks of the criminality, and then they're taken out by the next up-and-coming young thug that's trying to earn his wings.
Hence the kind of succession of gangland hits and murders that we see. We hear about them probably, you know, once a fortnight at the moment.
Absolutely. And that's the unfortunate thing, that you have so many young people who are quite prepared to point a gun at a person, pull the trigger and end a person's life. It's absolutely unbelievable now compared to what it was years ago.
Niamh Horrigan in Cork, a senior lecturer in sociology at University College there. You looked at the situation in Limerick. Now, we heard Nicola there talk about that narrow area in Dublin where you have the six gangs and they have things tightly controlled. How did you assess, or how would you summarise the situation in Limerick that you studied?
Well, there are very strong parallels in the sense that kind of organised criminal activity in was confined to pockets of particular areas where I suppose a lot of the energy of gangs went into maintaining a certain level of control. And as Nicola highlighted there, surveilling often kind of the innocent citizens who were living side by side with them, and also maintaining surveillance in terms of who was coming into the area in terms of criminal justice agents, etc. I suppose one of the interesting things about Limerick is that it's gone from having been really quite a hotbed of organised criminal activity to having calmed down considerably in recent years. And now, to a certain extent, I think this is a reflection of a certain deflation in the demand for some types of drugs, particularly cocaine, that has kind of come around with the recession. And I also think it has been due to the success of some of the, you know, criminal justice measures that were taking place. And I suppose what's really striking there has been the combination of kind of youth intervention type approaches which aim to target, and I suppose this is one of the very significant things that we highlighted in Limerick, was the way in which young people of younger and younger ages were being sucked in to criminal gang activity, and that was one side of the strategy. And then the other side was quite targeted policing measures in terms of, you know, emergency response unit surveillance, CCTV, and a whole range of what we call intelligence led policing. And it's the two factors, Sean, that I think have really contributed to a considerable quietening down in that area. And I suppose one of my concerns would be both in terms of Dublin 8 and in terms of Limerick would be that kind of the cutbacks that we've seen in the last couple of years may undo some of that good work, and we could be laying the foundations for, you know, an even stronger criminal culture emerging in the future.
Is there a sense that people can just get themselves out of poverty, out of maybe humdrum kind of life on the dole by just engaging in high risk? And I suppose that in one sense carries its own kicks, but they can activity, and that they can get themselves, give themselves a material lift in life.
Yeah, that was a real factor when I started my own research, which was in 2007. And this was the kind of dying days of the Celtic Tiger. And what was really striking was that some of the more able of the criminal fraternity were using, I suppose, the financial rewards of their activities to get precisely the kind of things that ordinary citizens in the Celtic Tiger were deeming desirable. So things like nice cars and fitted kitchens and foreign holidays. I suppose the other thing is that for many people living in those communities, both those involved in criminal activities and those who were not at all involved in criminal activities, Sean, many of them felt that in the outside community, they were stigmatised, that they were viewed essentially as scumbags, and that by engaging in these kind of activities, they became respected. Now, it was a respect based on fear, not based on being liked or being a good person. But nevertheless, it was a form of respect. And that was a definite reward for them in engaging that kind of in these kind of activities. And again, it's something we see very strongly in Dublin.
Maybe status as much or more than respect. And what about the involvement of women in those situations and settings?
Well, this was a kind of an emerging strong pattern at the time that I looked at it. It would very much reflect what we see in criminal gang activity internationally. I know there's been certain speculation about recent assassination attempts in the Costa del Sol and the involvement of women. One of the things that was very striking in my research was at the younger level, there was a lot more, I suppose, boys and girls involved. To a certain extent, at the adult level, we see more of an emphasis on women at the time I looked at it as partners. And I suppose, again, recently, we've seen a lot of focus on the role of women, particularly in providing witness testimony in the conviction of Wayne Dundon, amongst others.
And Nicola, just on that point of the involvement of women, that seems to have been one of the elements that's widely speculated on in the most recent killing on the Costa.
I think that was probably just a knee-jerk reaction initially to when Hatchet Kavanagh was shot dead, because he had been back here working as an enforcer for the Kinahan mob, and there had been incidents with the wife of a known criminal. But there doesn't seem to be any intelligence at all to suggest that that's correct.
And what about the lifestyle then that people have been able to secure for themselves as a result of their ill-gotten gains?
Well, actually, I was actually out in Spain last year with my colleague Mick McCaffrey. We did a 6-month investigation into the Kinahan mob, and we went out at the end of it to try and get an idea for ourselves exactly how they were living out there. And it was just absolutely mind-boggling when you see it, because when the Criminal Assets Bureau was brought in here, and we've seen, you know, few people will remember what it was like before then. But when it was brought in here, that stopped all the purchasing of sports cars and the big houses and all that. That was wiped out. So the only place they can actually still do it is probably abroad. And Spain is one place where the spending of money, the villas they're living in, the Ferraris, the lifestyle they have is just phenomenal. And you forget that it used to be like that here.
Is there no such thing as the equivalent of the CAB in Spain? Clearly,
well,
not.
Well, there actually is, and it's not that long set up, and one of their first investigations was into the Kinahan mob. But they don't seem to police it the same way we do here. There's also a historic situation out on the Costa del Sol, the Costa del Crime as it's also known as, that there's so many criminals from different countries living out there than it had, the Spanish police out there have sort of been heavily accused of being somewhat corrupt and maybe taking bribes from them. So it's all allowed to continue. So there's an element of that, I would imagine, still ongoing out there.
Brian Sherry, it kind of undoes the effectiveness and the good work of colleagues of your own in An Garda Síochána, and also the efforts of legislators to give the Gardaí the tools with which to fight criminal gangs, if they can just simply up stakes, a bit like mobile capital would in the creation of legitimate employment, and go to have the good life on the south of Spain.
I agree with you, Sean. Basically, like the setting up of the Criminal Assets Bureau here in Ireland was a fantastic piece of legislation brought in the mid-90s there. And the interesting thing about it was, like, I mean, you didn't have to be actually convicted of a criminal offence to have your assets seized. Unfortunately, in Spain and other European countries at the moment, there's a requirement in law that you must be convicted of a criminal offence to have your assets seized. And that is what has attracted a lot of the criminals from all over Eastern Europe, the Russian bloc, and Ireland and England and the Netherlands, over to France, over to Spain and places like that, where they can actually ply their trade and enjoy the proceeds of their crimes.
You don't get any sense of an international desire, do you, Nicola, to crack down on that?
Well, they say that if they crack down on crime properly in Spain, that the economy of the Costa del Sol would collapse, which is not something that I'd be surprised by. Even from the Irish mob, from the Kinahan mob, they have huge investment in Puerto Banús, which is a town that would be known by golfers and many people have holidayed out there. But they have bought up a lot of businesses around that area, and they're running them as to launder their funds.
What's the word, by the way? John Gilligan seems to have gone underground since there was that very serious attempt in his life, what, in the last 7 or 8 months?
Yeah, John Gilligan moved to the UK, where he was said to be recovering from his injuries. John Gilligan hasn't popped up yet, but will, undoubtedly. If I knew where he was at the moment, I probably wouldn't be sitting here. But it's believed he's still in the UK, where he's recuperating.
The other thing, Brian, of course, is the not just drugs, but cigarettes seems to be a very lucrative form of criminal activity as well.
Cigarettes has played a huge role in crime here in Ireland, and a huge loss to the revenue. The customs and excise people have been exceptionally very proactive in trying to prevent these types of crimes. But unfortunately, there's that many ports arriving and that many shipments, it's nearly impossibility to check every single container that comes into the country, but there's vast, huge resources and huge money is made in profits from that, and a lot of that is going into dissident Republican movements as well, and there's a huge amount of diesel laundering, and there's every sort of conniving business in construction and everything like that that the provisional or the ex-provisional IRA are involved in as well.
How well organised, Nicola, is the illegal cigarette trade?
It's enormous, absolutely enormous. The risk is quite minimal because basically, if you go out, and I was out in Indonesia recently investigating the purchasing of the cigarettes, they're buying them all over Asia. So you can buy a container load of cigarettes out there for $100,000, right? For your $100,000, they will be landed somewhere within Europe for you. So you get them as far and past the customs into Europe, and then you bring it into Ireland. That one container is worth 1.9 million. So even if one of them is got, you're losing $100,000. You get it through, you're making phenomenal profits. Most of it is coming into South Armagh. Most of it is run by the dissidents. Anybody who's importing cigarettes outside the dissidents are paying them a tithe to allow them operate. And it's massive, massive business.
You first alluded there, Brian, to the dissident Republicans particularly. Do you think, or do you have a sense that there might be maybe in their possession much weaponry that did not get decommissioned?
Well, in my honest opinion is, yes, I honestly do believe a vast amount of firearms were absolutely, there's no doubt about it, were destroyed. But I've absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, satisfied that there was bunkers that were all over Ireland that were not handed over, and there was people who knew about those and knew where they were and were distributing those weapons, and those weapons are still out on the streets.
Okay, on that note, we'll leave it there. Brian Cherry, retired detective inspector, Dr. Niamh Harrigan, senior lecturer in sociology at University College Cork, and Nicola Tallant, investigations editor with Sunday World. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be talking religion after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.